Come in immediately. The caller did not need to identify himself. Parr recognized the urgency in the voice of the CIA's senior communicator. Arriving at the office, Parr saw the message headed with the word immediate, followed by NIACT for night action, which required an immediate response, regardless of the time of day. This message originated from a country friendly to the United States, and whose political leaders were frequent targets of terrorists. Reportedly, the country's intelligence chief had acquired what seemed to be a suitcase bomb from a terrorist cell. For reasons unknown, the intelligence chief had taken the suitcase to his office, opened it, and noticed wires in one corner, along with some unidentified materials wrapped in black tape. Then he apparently suffered a sudden attack of brilliance and decided not to mess with it anymore, Parr recalled. That's when he called the CIA for help. Parr replied with his own immediate NIACT, with questions about the appearance of the device, and remained at home for the rest of the night, responding to additional messages before catching the morning flight out to see the device in person. Reaching his destination before noon, Parr was taken to an office where the open suitcase sat on a desk. Almost certainly a bomb, the suitcase contained a messy collection of wires, small boxes wrapped in black tape, and miscellaneous packing materials. When an X-ray machine was located at a nearby prison, the suitcase was carefully transported there. The X-ray image revealed a coil pattern in one of the taped packages that Parr concluded was detonator cord, wrapped around another unidentifiable substance, probably high explosive. The trigger mechanism to control the detonation was circuit board wired to the coil. Parr calculated that he could pull the electronics away from the explosives without initiating a detonation. Taking the device to a remote area, he attached a hook on a long line to the electronics and gave it a hard yank from a safe distance. The electronics, which had been attached to the blasting cap with black tape, pulled cleanly away from the explosives. After cutting off the blasting cap, he X-rayed the device again to recheck the circuitry. With the device rendered safe, follow-up operational ideas began emerging. The bomb had been obtained through an agent who penetrated a terrorist cell. If a signaling device could be attached and the suitcase reinserted into the cache, it could be tracked to determine its intended target. However, to do so, the bomb would have to be reassembled. Parr knew that since he took it apart, he could put it back together, but the agent had only a few hours to return the device to the cache before someone discovered it missing. Not only did that rule out a tracking operation, headquarters, quite sensibly, disapproved of returning a live bomb to a terrorist cache. The tech would have to reassemble a disabled bomb without leaving any traces of tampering. Using a layer of epoxy to short out the wiring from the switch to the blasting cap was relatively simple, but reassembling the bomb in its case without leaving signs of alteration required several hours. The sleep-deprived tech finally completed the reassembly and delivered the bomb to the local service for return to the cache. Sometime in the future, at an unknown time and place, a terrorist's plot would fail. In the course of disassembling and reassembling the components, Parr examined the electronic circuit board, took photos, and made sketches. The device contained components he had not seen in terrorist devices, revealing a new type of timing device that subsequently appeared in other bombs as a trademark for a particular PLO bomb maker. "You deserve a medal," the chief told Parr as he departed. "I don't think so," Parr replied. "I've spent most of my life in Vietnam and Laos making devices that help kill people. It seems a little ridiculous to give me a medal when I disarm a device." Nevertheless, a few months later, based on the recommendation of the chief, Parr did, in fact, receive the CIA's Intelligence Star for a voluntary act of courage performed under hazardous conditions. In December 1988, John Orkin was heading an OTS unit responsible for conducting technical design and performance assessments of spy equipment deployed against American targets by the Soviets or other adversaries. These devices were usually discovered either through technical surveillance countermeasures or acquired from a friendly liaison service. Typically, Orkin's engineers analyzed each recovered device to determine its country of origin, function, materials, design, and capabilities. This was no easy task, since intelligence organizations routinely mask the country of origin of a device by sanitizing spy gear. Since a bug found in the wall of a diplomat's office was not usually stamped "Made in the Soviet Union" or came with an instruction manual, Orkin's job was to figure out how a mysterious device worked, who made it, and how it might have been deployed. With a well-equipped suite in the sprawling OTS covert laboratory outside Washington, Orkin joked that he was far enough from the Langley headquarters to do real engineering work without interruption or micromanagement. The lab was largely immune from the crisis-to-crisis atmosphere that dominated many intelligence operations. Orkin began his CIA career during the early 1970s evaluating OTS equipment. Responsible for testing every piece of spy gear produced by OTS before certifying it for deployment to the field, the unit functioned as the agency's in-house underwriter's laboratory. Far removed from the glamour associated with agents, spies, and back-alley intrigue, testing the frequencies of transmitters and battery life of communication devices in a government laboratory seemed a world away from the front lines of espionage. The certification of OTS devices and analysis of hostile gear involved both elements of reverse engineering and similar testing procedures. However, during the 1970s, analysis of foreign devices was an ad hoc affair. As a device was recovered, the lucky engineer of the day got assigned the project to test and write a report on how the foreign equipment performed, explained Orkin. We were dealing with mostly technical surveillance equipment, microphones, transmitters, communication and concealment devices. Eventually, it became apparent that we were reinventing the wheel with each analysis. When a device came in, we often didn't remember if we'd seen the same thing 3 years before or if there was already a report in the file. So one of the engineers finally said, "Give them all to me. I'll do the work." Over time, he became the in-house repository of knowledge about foreign equipment. Eventually, this led OTS to establish a unit with expertise in reverse engineering foreign equipment and a proficiency in spotting patterns that accompanied technological evolution. Although the number of new devices might be fewer than 10 a year, analysis was needed to establish continuity. We needed to develop data to do a side-by-side comparison to look at the evolution of devices, he said. We needed to know with certainty if two devices were identical, and if not, then document the changes and record the improvements. The Soviet Union remained the focus for OTS foreign equipment testing well into the 1980s. The work analyzing Soviet and East European spy devices offered invaluable counterintelligence data for the FBI, State Department, and U.S. military security components that were also developing countermeasures. However, with the number of terrorist organizations multiplying in Africa, Europe, the Middle East, and Asia in the 1970s, the agency began acquiring explosives and bomb fragments from terrorist caches and post-blast investigations. As most early terrorist bombs were individually fabricated from whatever parts and materials the bomb maker had at hand, these were collectively known as improvised explosive devices, or IEDs. The OTS expertise in reverse engineering and knowledge of foreign electronic circuits proved to be the perfect match for unraveling the firing, triggering, and timing mysteries of these weapons. It was in this way, almost by accident, that Orkin and his colleagues became the agency's focal point for collecting, analyzing, and cataloging instruments of terror. The analysis of terrorist devices evolved slowly. It was an occasional item here and there. In fact, we initiated some activity ourselves, going to the counterterrorism officers and asking them, "What do you have?" And they'd say, "Oh, here's a device that I picked up in Jordan in 1978, and we'd offer to do a report," remembered Orkin. Initially, we were working backwards on stuff found a few years before. If anything looked like it had been made in more than one quantity, or if it looked like something we might see again, we'd take it and do a report on it. Orkin began detecting a disturbing pattern of state-of-the-art technology making its way into terrorist devices in the early 1980s. Terror organizations that relied on crude timers and other components for their bombs a few years earlier were now acquiring advanced technology that greatly increased the lethality of terrorist bombs. The reason that technology became available was because of state-supported terrorism. Terrorists could buy the needed technology because Syria, Libya, and a few other countries like Iran and Iraq were giving them money, said Orkin. Initially, they used very simple devices, like timers that you had in your kitchen, alarm clocks, and wristwatches with the hole drilled in the center. They really used the kind of basic stuff you see in the movies. I put 1984 as the date when they began to apply newer technologies to these devices. We began seeing multiple examples of the same device, indicating that they were fabricating them in small production runs. This was a significant turn of events. Terrorists could now get electronics engineers to design the timing circuit for a bomb, instead of relying on someone with little training working in his cellar with a soldering iron. Terrorists, who had traditionally been impassioned amateurs, were finding allies, tutors, and funding from the intelligence professionals of rogue countries. Established governments were now directly aiding terrorism by providing cash and enabling networks for procurement and shipment of components and devices. Throughout the 80s, the terrorists progressed from devices that were fairly simple to those of professional quality, explained Orkin. We saw the devices evolve. We would think, boy, that's not a good way to do this. And when the next device came in, we'd see the problem fixed. Orkin, an intelligence officer as well as engineer, pinpointed a potential vulnerability that might be exploited. The more advanced and technologically specialized each component became, the more likely it could be traced back through supply channels to specific manufacturers. Embedded in every chip and circuit board were technical and engineering details that, when pieced together, sometimes revealed the genealogy of the device, including its sponsor and even assembler. For instance, lot numbers denoting manufacturing runs used for inventory control, coupled with standardized fabricating processes, gave virtually every component a personal history. Working out the technological DNA of terrorist devices, the foreign finds experts uncovered yet another disturbing trend. Terror organizations were no longer working in isolation. They were now forging ties with rogue nations and each other. In one instance, when analyzing a device uncovered in the Middle East, he noted features of an elaborate, high-powered radio receiver with British markings. We kept finding components that were marked from a British company, and when we showed it to the British, they identified it as PIRA, Provisional IRA, technology, recalled Orkin. British analysis had concluded that PIRA traded technology for guns and explosives with the Libyans. Libya also trained some of the PIRA guys who handed them the technology. There was another incident in Peru, and when we looked at it, we said this looks like the other device from PIRA. What eventually emerged was a complex interlocking network of terrorist organizations. For example, PIRA technology could support the ETA, Euskadi Ta Askatasuna, in Spain, and ETA could hand off some of the equipment to Shining Path in Peru, and so on and so on. While these groups did not always share political or social agendas, they did share a common desire for bomb-making technology. It was getting harder and harder to differentiate between groups by their technology, explained Orkin. The ringing bells and songs of carolers on Christmas Day 1988 sounded with little joy or peace for families of the 259 passengers and crew of Pan Am Flight 103. 4 days earlier, just after 7 p.m. on December 21st, a bomb ripped a hole in the forward fuselage of the Boeing 747 as the plane reached its cruising altitude of 31,000 feet over Scotland. Stunned air traffic controllers at London's Heathrow Airport watched the aircraft vanish from their radar screens, replaced by small blips as nearly 700,000 pounds of airborne debris, including flaming jet fuel, rained down on the small town of Lockerbie. 270 perished that day, all those aboard the plane, and 11 residents of Lockerbie. Death and destruction in the air and on the ground turned the anticipation and joy of the Christmas holidays that traditionally unites friends and co-workers in a spirit of joyous goodwill into a season of mourning. The next day, CIA casualty officers suspended holiday plans after learning that among the dead was a CIA officer. Another star would be chiseled into the white marble of the agency's memorial wall of the original headquarters building. Even for those not directly touched by the tragedy, the grim images of the wreckage on covers of magazines carried a stark reminder that evil honored no holiday. The debris field, spread over more than 800 square miles, was a horrific scene of human remains, personal effects, and pieces of aircraft. The plane had not exploded, but broken apart as it plummeted to Earth. Few news organizations captured or broadcast images of the most gruesome elements of the crash site. However, one photo that shocked and sickened the world eventually became a morbid visual shorthand for the tragedy. That was the image of the battered nose section of the 747 with the cheerful script, "Made of the Seas," resting on its side in a muddy field. Nearly 20 years later, even those who can recall few of the details surrounding the tragedy of Flight 103 remember that image vividly. Terrorism was not new to the agency or unknown to viewers of the evening news. Nevertheless, Pan Am Flight 103 seemed different. The plane was not in a war-torn country. Those aboard were students, husbands, and mothers. Their faces, revealed to the world smiling in family photos, showed ordinary lives ended in a violent and grotesque manner. What could the perpetrators possibly hope to gain by murdering college students returning home for Christmas vacation? What message were they hoping to send? The senseless slaughter defied all reasonable motivation and strained even the tortured logic of terrorism. CIA officials quickly concluded that this was a terrorist attack, even if the identity of the perpetrators and their motives were unknown. Reports from around the world identified groups eager to claim credit for the cruel spectacle. Critical details began emerging over the following weeks as investigators assembled information from agent reports, signals intelligence, and fragments of the plane. The bomb had been concealed in a commercial Toshiba radio cassette player, the Bomb Beat, model RT-SF-16, available in consumer electronics stores. Fragments of the radio, as well as the owner's manual, were recovered in the wreckage of the cargo container where the blast originated. Traces of the plastic explosive Semtex were found on the radio circuit board, and experts calculated that no more than 400 grams, about 14 ounces, positioned close enough to an outer bulkhead, was enough to blast an 18-inch hole through the fuselage. Within seconds after the detonation, the plane decompressed, suffered structural failure, and tore itself apart in the sky. But more puzzling than the presence of Semtex or the cassette player was what remained of a brown Samsonite suitcase. Tests revealed traces of Semtex on the suitcase fragments, indicating that it more than likely held the bomb. Yet no such suitcase was checked in as baggage at Malta, the departure point for the baggage container where the blast occurred, and investigators were unable to match the brown, hard-shell piece of luggage to any passenger aboard the plane. From the start, the investigators focused on the use of Semtex. The explosive of choice among many terrorists, it is difficult to detect, but relatively easy to obtain. Counterterrorism experts suspected Palestinian groups based in Syria, which had used the explosive in past attacks and had a history of relying on consumer electronics as carriers. Iranian terrorists also favored the explosive, a fact that focused attention on an Iranian national aboard the flight's Frankfurt to London leg who disembarked before the plane's departure for New York. Although investigators understood what had happened, their study of the debris field and wreckage yielded little about who did it and how the bomb had been placed on the airliner. The break did not come for 18 months. Then, nearly 80 miles from the center of the debris field, a local man stumbled onto the remnant of a T-shirt bearing the label of Mary's House, a store in Malta's port town of Sliema. Embedded in the material of the garment was a thumbnail-sized fragment of circuit board, about 0.4 inches square. That tiny speck of forensic evidence would eventually lead to the unraveling of a terrorist plot and test the international justice system. However, the trail to the Lockerbie bombers began not in a European capital or the Middle East, but in sub-Saharan Africa. The Republic of Chad, a former French colony, is known primarily for the exotic name of its capital city, N'Djamena. Despite decades of ethnic warfare and limited strategic significance in the Cold War, the United States maintained relationships with Chad's government. In the early 1980s, the local security service uncovered what they assumed to be a case of espionage and quickly moved in for an arrest. When the suspected spy was taken into custody, his suitcase surprisingly contained not a collection of standard spy gear, but a quantity of Semtex attached to a portable radio. Without the capability to conduct an in-depth technical analysis, Chad's intelligence service passed the device on to the CIA. The device, Orkin noted, was unexpectedly complex. The sophisticated circuitry was controlled by a standard pager traced to a firm, Meister & Ballier AG, MIBO, based in Zurich, Switzerland. Known to have ties to both Libyan and East German intelligence organizations, the company's circuits were apparently now being used in a terrorist IED. A few years later, in the autumn of 1986, local authorities uncovered a terrorist cache of weapons in Togo's capital, Lomé, and U.S. authorities were invited to examine these materials. Among the hodgepodge of aging weaponry and munitions, two state-of-the-art timers stood out, one of which Orkin acquired for analysis. Like the find in Chad, the device was also traced back to Switzerland and MIBO. Then, in February of 1988, two known Libyan intelligence operatives were arrested in Dakar, Senegal, as they disembarked from their flight. Items found in one of the passengers' briefcases included a silenced pistol, ammunition, four blocks of TNT, and two blocks of Semtex, along with a timer. Local authorities allowed CIA officers to photograph the timer. The photograph, like the timers from Chad and Togo, eventually landed at Orkin's lab. Again, MIBO appeared linked to the device. In retrospect, the devices from Chad were first generation, Orkin explained. Then we observed that the device from Togo was a prototype. We said, if you cut the corners out here and change this and change that, you can put it in a box and make it look nice. And that's exactly what we got in the Senegal device. It was a packaged unit. The terrorists had learned the engineering principles of form, fit, and function. Orkin now had three increasingly sophisticated devices, all from Africa, all physically linked to the same manufacturer in Switzerland, and all with some Libyan connection. A report on each rested in the OTS archives as technological curiosities of no immediate intelligence value. Then came Pan Am 103. By September of 1989, Scottish investigators converged on Mary's House clothing store in Malta, led there by the scrap of T-shirt. The shop's owner remembered the customer who bought the T-shirt, describing him as a Middle Eastern man who shopped indiscriminately, purchasing items without regard to size, as if he were simply trying to fill a suitcase, which, of course, is precisely what he was doing. The police produced a sketch of the buyer from the store owner's recollections, though there was, as yet, no name to go with the face. The Scots were still having a difficult time identifying the tiny piece of circuit board found embedded in the shirt. Unable to match it up to any piece of the plane or known electronic component, they sent a photograph of it to the FBI, with the understanding that it would not be released outside the Bureau. Analysis of the photograph yielded little, if anything, new. After 6 months, the FBI received permission to show the photo to other U.S. government agencies. That same day, Orkin received an unexpected call. The guy calls me from the FBI's explosives unit. He came out to my lab, pulled out the picture, plus a one-page report with a brief description of the fragment that says it's epoxy fiberglass and 7-ply board, said Orkin. It also makes note of the fact that there was green solder masking. Solder masking is used to prevent solder flowing to parts of the board where you don't want it. Orkin had seen the same design before. The green solder masking, coupled with the curve of the board, matched previous reports done on the devices found in Togo and Senegal and associated with Libya. Then he discovered that the fabrication techniques, along with a modified connector, matched the device found in Chad. They all pointed to the Swiss firm Mebo. The connection, though still tenuous, represented a starting point. Beginning with this information about the components found on the African circuit boards, the FBI launched a global investigation. The FBI traced the components, eventually tracking the timing crystal to a specific company. Asked about the component, the firm consulted its records, which showed that 100 of them had been sold to Mebo, establishing a definite link back to the Swiss firm. Next, the investigators went to Mebo. As Orkin later heard the story, the investigators were told, "Yes, we built 10 with the plastic case and 10 without the plastic case for the Libyans." Then, realizing what had been revealed, the manager decided not to talk with the investigators anymore. Called the MST-13, the timer unit was made specifically for the Libyan government's Ministry of Defense. The precision device could be set to delay an explosion up to 10,000 hours or 10,000 minutes. "This was an elaborate timer with crystal timing controls that were very accurate," explained Orkin. "This timer had been in a suitcase placed on a plane going from Malta to Frankfurt. In Germany, the luggage was changed to another flight going to London and then put on Pan Am 103. It was set to wait many hours before triggering the explosion." Based on the recovered evidence, the timer apparently had been set with the intention of sending the plane down into the Atlantic. However, an unexpected weather delay at Heathrow Airport and high winds diverted the flight path over Scotland. Had the plane taken off as scheduled, the bomb would have detonated over the ocean and all evidence likely destroyed or lost forever. With these discoveries, suspicion shifted from the Syrians and Palestinians to the Libyan government. A defector named two Libyan intelligence officers whom he claimed were behind the Pan Am 103 bombing. The first, Abdel Basset Ali Al-Megrahi, was identified as the Mary's House customer who purchased the T-shirt and other clothing used to fill the suitcase containing the Semtex. The second Libyan, Al-Amin Khalifa Fahimah, had a cover job with Libyan Arab Airlines at Malta's airport. This put them in a perfect position to smuggle the brown Samsonite suitcase into the plane's cargo hold. The problem for investigators and prosecution was that both suspects were now back in their home country, where Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi was steadfastly rejecting requests to hand them over for trial. More pieces of the puzzle fell into place in March of 1990, following the collapse of the Soviet Union. Semtex, the plastic explosive used, was manufactured in Czechoslovakia. The name was derived from the first four letters of the company that first manufactured it in the 1960s, the Semtin Glassworks, plus the suffix X, denoting the English word for explosive. During a well-publicized press conference in London, Czechoslovak President Václav Havel revealed that his country, while under communist rule, sold an estimated 100 tons, 2 million pounds, of Semtex to Libya. The Libyans, Havel added, had refused to return the explosives. By 1992, with evidence pointing decidedly at Libya, the case came before the United Nations Security Council. Sanctions were imposed, and negotiations with the Libyan government dragged on for 6 long years. Then, in 1998, as sanctions became an economic burden, the Libyans finally agreed to turn over the two accused men for trial. The trial was scheduled to take place at Camp Zeist, a former U.S. military base in the Netherlands that had been declared within Scottish jurisdiction for the purposes of the trial. As the prosecution began assembling the case, it became clear the timers would play the key role in linking the two Libyan intelligence officers to the flight. According to Scottish law, the prosecution was obliged to show the defense how the investigators were led to the timing device. This put Orkin, whose entire professional life had been conducted under a cover unassociated with the CIA, in an unusual position. he would appear in open court as an expert witness in an internationally watched trial. The agency offered unprecedented assistance in the trial. Not only would Orkin